KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. After 6 weeks of cutting the federal workforce and foreign aid, President Trump says America's spirit is back. What he told Congress about his plans as he attacked Democrats on Morning Edition from NPR News. Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia was in the audience last night and talks of legislation to end the trade war with Canada. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, we'll hear his response to the president. Also, what leaders in Taiwan, wary of a Chinese attack, are learning from Trump's policy toward Ukraine. And Crimean Tartar Jazz, the pop music of Soviet-era Central Asia. It is Wednesday, March 5th. On this day in 1963, the hula hoop was patented by Wham-O, the same company behind another classic, the Frisbee. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The U.S. Supreme Court has declined to overrule a lower court decision ordering the Trump administration to pay some contractors for foreign aid work. This is linked with Trump's freeze on foreign aid. It affects the U.S. Agency for International Development and the State Department. President Trump gave his address to a joint session of Congress last night. He told lawmakers he'll accelerate his efforts to dramatically reshape the federal government. Trump also pointed to his work to stop illegal immigration into the U.S. NPR's Jimenez Bustillo reports Trump is claiming illegal border crossings into the U.S. have fallen to their lowest level ever.
The agency itself, that's Customs and Border Protection, has not reported the numbers for February. However, posts on social media by the president suggest the administration believes it's on track to report about 8,500 arrests at the U.S.-Mexico border in the month of February. This could be the lowest number of crossings since Homeland Security started reporting the data in 2000.
NPR's Jimena Bustillo reporting. Russia says it welcomes renewed efforts by the White House to end the war in Ukraine. The Kremlin was responding to the president's claim in his congressional address last night, Ukraine is ready to negotiate a peace. NPR's Charles Maines has more.
Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Ukraine's willingness to negotiate, if true, was a positive development, but there were nuances hindering talks. According to the spokesman, that includes whether Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky can legally participate, given a wartime decree Zelensky issued that rules out negotiations with the Kremlin. Moscow has also sought to sideline Zelensky by arguing he is illegitimate in power, only thanks to wartime martial law that bans elections. It's a Russian talking point President Trump is occasionally embraced, and one more reason why Ukraine and traditional American allies in Europe fear Trump seeks a negotiated peace tilted in Moscow's favor. Charles Maines, NPR News.
There's uncertainty over the direction of President Trump's new 25% tariffs on Mexico and Canada. U.S. tariffs on imported oil from Canada are lower. They're at 10%. But analysts say as a result, gas prices at the pump are still going to skyrocket. NPR's Camila Domonoske reports that could happen in days.
Patrick DeHaan of the app Gas Buddy says the Northeast will be hit the hardest and fastest. The region relies on gasoline and diesel straight from Canada. Here he is in a video.
Prices could start going up by a total of 20 to 40 cents a gallon over the next 7 to 10 days.
The Midwest, Great Lakes, and Rockies will feel it next. Their refineries import Canadian crude oil to turn into gasoline. The U.S. makes more crude oil than it needs, but not the right kind of oil and not in the right place for any easy swap. The West Coast and the South are not expected to feel much impact. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 50 points. This is NPR. A major winter storm is hammering much of the central U.S. and sweeping to the east. There are blizzard conditions from northern Missouri to Michigan's Upper Peninsula. The storm is also bringing damaging winds to the south. At least two people have been killed in Mississippi. A research team says it thinks it has the tools scientists need to possibly detect fossilized microbial life on Mars. Reporter Ari Daniel explains.
The machine is about the size of a water bottle, and it was built to detect different elements, including the chemical signatures of life. Yusuf Salam is a PhD student at the University of Bern.
It's basically a laser beam hitting the sample, and this laser will vaporize part of the material, creating some atoms.
Salam used the instrument on a piece of gypsum he harvested from northern Algeria, gypsum that he knew contained fossilized microbes.
We proved that our instrument is capable to detect signatures of life in the gypsum.
Since gypsum is present on Mars as well, perhaps one day the instrument could be used to look for ancient microbes on the red planet, too. The study highlights the intimate interconnection between minerals and microbes on our planet, and perhaps beyond. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
The Vatican says Pope Francis has been taken off mechanical ventilation today. He used this to help his breathing and to sleep overnight. Francis remains hospitalized in stable condition in a Rome hospital. The news comes as the Christian holy season of Lent starts. Today is Ash Wednesday. Christians will use the season to prepare for Easter. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital markets solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia responds to the president's speech last night. First, we hear what the president said to Congress. He proclaimed that in his view, America is back.
For more than 90 minutes, he talked of securing the border, slashing government, and imposing tariffs. And he said he did not expect much support from Democrats.
These people sitting right here will not clap, will not stand, and certainly will not cheer for these astronomical achievements. They won't do it, no matter what.
The opposition party did spend most of his speech stony-faced, seated, or protesting.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez was listening to all of those minutes, and he joins us now. Franco, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What was it like?
Yeah, I mean, there was always, you know, some kind of tension in these kind of speeches, but last night that tension was really so much higher. I mean, in the first 5 minutes, a Democratic congressman, Al Green of Texas, stood up in protest. He was waving his cane and calling out that Trump didn't have a mandate. And when he wouldn't sit down, House Speaker Mike Johnson actually had him escorted out of the chamber, which was a first as far as I can remember. And throughout the speech, Republicans were cheering, Democrats were holding up these signs that read things like false and save Medicaid, and just repeatedly, Trump would go after former President Joe Biden by name and calling Democrats radical left lunatics. I mean, the partisan nature of this speech is really likely what this is going to be remembered for.
Well, the president certainly celebrated some of his more divisive or partisan achievements.
Yeah, Trump actually spent a lot of time touting the work of Elon Musk and his project to cut costs, known as the Department of Government Efficiency. And he got into some of the nitty-gritty, giving this long list of examples that he said were being cut. Here's a small part.
$40 million to improve the social and economic inclusion of sedentary migrants. Nobody knows what that is. $8 million to promote LGBTQI+ in the African nation of Lesotho, which nobody has ever heard of.
Now, Steve, Trump's critics have said some of these cuts were for necessary services like aid for starving children. And in some cases, the White House did acknowledge this and rehired people. But NPR has also looked into some of the claims of savings posted on the DOGE website, and documents show that most of those savings don't actually exist. Hmm.
Well, did the president talk about his plans for the year ahead? This can be a table-setting moment.
Yeah, a little bit. He asked Congress to pass his tax cuts. He talked about a plan that he'll announce this week to expand production of critical minerals in the U.S. But he really spent most of his time talking about things that he's already done.
Well, did he use guests in attendance to make his points, as presidents often do?
He did. He did. And that kind of shows, the priorities. A lot of the guests were victims of crime or worked in law enforcement. There was this really heartwarming moment when Trump honored a 13-year-old boy who has fought brain cancer. He was dressed in a police uniform, and Trump said he had a special surprise for him.
Tonight, DJ, we're going to do you the biggest honor of them all. I am asking our new Secret Service Director, Sean Curran, to officially make you an agent of the United States Secret Service.
Trump's Secret Service director then came out and gave him a badge and a hug.
In this 90-minute or more speech, Franco, did anything go unsaid?
Well, I mean, one of the biggest concerns Americans have is their grocery bills. And Trump promised to cut high prices, but we really didn't hear anything new about those plans. He just blamed Biden.
That's White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Franco, thanks so much.
Thanks, Steve.
So we've been hearing about President Trump's speech last night, where he delivered his take on what he views as his accomplishments so far. Alyssa Slotkin, a newly elected Democratic senator from Michigan, delivered the Democratic response. She acknowledged that Democrats were defeated in November because of voters' concerns about the cost of living and their desire for a more responsive government. But she also said that that is not what Trump is going to deliver.
President Trump is trying to deliver an unprecedented giveaway to his billionaire friends. He's on the hunt to find trillions of dollars to pass along to the wealthiest in America. And to do that, he's going to make you pay in every part of your life.
We're going to get more reaction now from another Democrat, Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, who was there in the chamber during this speech. Good morning, Senator. Thanks so much for getting up early with us after a long night.
Hey, Michelle. Great to be with you today.
Let me just briefly touch on the atmosphere since you were there. You know, you heard my colleague Franco Ordonez say that he mentioned the moment when Congressman Al Green of Texas stood up and shouted, "Mr. President, you don't have a mandate." He was referring to the Medicaid cuts. He was escorted out. Other times, Democrats sat on their hands or waved these, small signs with different sort of messages on it. What's your take on how that went?
Michelle, the State of the Union always has some fun theater to it. I mean, when the Senate processes in, the House members welcome us, thanks for coming over, pomp and circumstance, the diplomatic corps. And there was that veneer last night. But I will say the mood in the room had a lot more anxiety, and not just on the Democratic side, anxiety undercurrents than any that I've been in. And I started doing these in 2013. There was anxiety about the economy with the tariff issue. There's anxiety about security in the aftermath of the horrible meeting in the Oval Office with the president of Ukraine last Friday. And there's even lingering anxiety about our democracy itself when you have a guy like Elon Musk seemingly in charge and people are remembering that the president just pardoned the January 6th protesters.
So you're telling us that you feel the Republicans were also feeling that anxiety, but what about how the Democrats responded in the moment? I mean, the reviews from some of the commentators were mixed. I mean, some took that as a kind of a metaphor for how the Democrats are responding to Mr. Trump overall, which is kind of incoherent. What's your response to that?
Well, the Democrats, I think it was Will Rogers who said, "I don't believe in organized political parties. That's why I'm a Democrat." We pride ourselves on being iconoclastic and individualistic. So folks, did it differently. Some chose to wear things or wave signs. Representative Green heckled the president. Some didn't attend. Some did attend. But I think the bottom line message that we strongly believe, and I think Alyssa Slotkin did a great job with this, Americans are worried about the economy, they're worried about security, and they're worried about democracy. And on the economy, that's number one. It's what President Trump campaigned on. And thus far, the results he's delivering are abysmal.
Is there anything in particular that you wanted to fact check? I mean, as you mentioned, your colleague Senator Slotkin's basic message was Trump said what he's going to do, but he's not really going to do that. Is there anything in particular you want to add, or is there anything in particular that you want to fact check?
Well, I'm in Virginia, and I'm watching the layoff of all these employees because of this DOGE project led by Trump, Russell Vogt, the OMB director, and Elon Musk. And when they're laying off FAA safety employees, and I brought a laid off FAA employee right after a tragic accident that killed 67 people at Reagan National Airport a month ago, and the layoffs happened since then? Are you kidding me? When they're waging a war on veterans, because 30% of the federal workforce is veteran, it's single digits in the civilian workforce. So when you lay a lot of people off, you are laying off veterans. And Donald Trump and these guys know it because they know who the federal workforce is. They are not just hurting the economy, but they're hurting a group of people that does not deserve to be a punching bag.
So obviously the federal workforce is a big factor for you. There, many of them are your constituents. Interestingly, you know, a lot of your state's exports, your state exports a lot more than I think many people might realize that it does. President Trump defended tariffs on Canada and Mexico in his speech. Last year, I think some 15% of your state's exports went to Canada, things like cars and transportation equipment. How do you respond to his defense of those tariffs?
They're disastrous. To put these tariffs on the three biggest trading partners of our country, who are also the three biggest trading partners of Virginia, and we got a particular soft spot for Canada because it's not just about exports out of our port and through railroad. Canadians also come to our beaches a lot, so we're very used to Canadians coming for tourism. They're just going to raise prices on everybody, and that's why I'm challenging the president's tariffs on Canada, because since he did it by emergency order, I can file a challenge and force the Senate to vote on it, and that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, say more about that. What exactly are you going to do about that?
Yep. So the president is imposing these tariffs pursuant to a declared emergency. Now, we know the president is declaring emergencies not really because of an emergency, but he just wants to, you know, bypass Congress. So last week, I forced a vote on a president's declared energy emergency. He said we're in an energy emergency, even though America's producing more energy than we ever have in the history of this country. And he's unplugging clean energy projects all over the United States. We voted on it last week. No Republicans would break with the president. But I'm now going to challenge the Canadian tariffs and say he cited fentanyl at the border. But the fentanyl issue is not a real issue with Canada. There's more fentanyl that goes from the U.S. to Canada than from Canada to the U.S. And it's a footnote to the real fentanyl problem, which is China and Mexico. So he's just inventing this Canadian emergency to start a trade war that's going to hurt Virginians. And we saw it in term one, and we're going to see it again right now.
So I understand you and I think your colleague Mark Warner, who's also from Virginia, have this legislation because you're challenging these tariffs because you say they're based on a false premise, but you have not been able to get any Republicans to vote with you so far on a similar challenge. What hope do you have that they will join you on this?
I think they're very, very nervous about these Canadian tariffs. And the good thing about this bill, Michelle, is I'm guaranteed a vote. It ripens and becomes the business of the Senate 15 days after I file it. So sometime by the end of March, you're going to see a vote on this. And I know a lot of Republicans are really worried about the effect these tariffs are going to have on their citizens.
That is Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia. He is a Democrat. Senator Kaine, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet, Michelle. Glad to be with you.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, two experts join us to explore the rapid dismantling of diversity, equity, and inclusion, commonly known as DEI, across public and private sectors. Once hailed as markers of social progress, conservative critics now portray DEI as emblematic of excessive woke culture. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BetterHelp, committed to making mental well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From EBSCO, providing researchers with access to biomedical and healthcare literature reviews with the goal of helping them conduct thorough reviews in less time. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The network of trade routes that stretched across Asia for centuries, the Silk Road, also helped send dance, theater, and music between continents. As NPR's Charles Maines reports, the Silk Road's legacy as a cultural crossroads persists and comes with a thumping beat.
In the late 1970s, Central Asia could seem like just another stagnating Soviet backwater. News of the day praised economic achievements that weren't real, and a socialist future few actually believed in. Yet those with an ear to the ground knew more was going on. That idea is at the heart of Synthesizing the Silk Roads, an anthology of rare Soviet Central Asian pop, released on Ostinato Records, an imprint that highlights overlooked global music. The album captures Central Asia's role as a forgotten cultural stomping ground, where East met West in an echo of the region's trade routes of old.
I can hear so many different cultures mingling in this music.
That's Ostinato founder Vic Sahoni. He says, are there shades of disco? Sure. But strange synthesizers and Central Asian folk melodies give the music a genre-bending twist. Meanwhile, the collection also features contributions from the region's wider ethnic patchwork, Korean brass bands, Crimean Tatar jazz, and garage rock from a Uyghur ensemble called Yashlik. Collectively, the recordings make the case the region offered far more than Iron Curtain kitsch. Sahoni argues the songs reveal the rhythms and dreams of the region's post-Soviet future.
There's a lot of different styles, and I think, again, it's just a testament that Central Asia is really, I mean, the word central, you know, couldn't be stronger. It is really a very central part of the entire world.
For all this, we can thank...
My name is Anvar Kalandarov.
Anvar Kalandarov.
Да, доброе утро.
An avid record collector in Uzbekistan's capital city of Tashkent, Kalandarov dug through the bargain bins at flea markets and traded with fellow music obsessives, amassing a collection of rare LPs. In fact, his love affair with Central Asian vinyl ran so deep, it got to the point where it was not only cramping his apartment, but his marriage.
My wife's a psychologist who treats people with addictions. One day she says, you have 2,000 records. Do you ever think about why you do this?
It was time, Kalandarov vowed, to finally share Central Asia's secret with the rest of us. In the process, he uncovered a hidden history that dates back to World War II and an order by Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin to evacuate millions of Soviets out of the reach of the invading German army. Sound engineers, critical to the Soviet propaganda machine, were among the new arrivals to Central Asia, where they came to form the backbone of Tashkent's Zavod Grampostinok, the Tashkent Record Factory. As Kalandarov explains,
by the 1960s, the factory was recording music from all over Central Asia, and it was all recorded here in Tashkent, and little musical acts popped up because of it.
As the factory grew, it churned out vinyl records by the millions, with many of those LPs making their way into clubs and discos in Tashkent and other cities in Central Asia. DJs wanted local artists in the rotation, and locals wanted to rotate and let off steam on the dance floor.
Серьезные наши ссоры. Да-да-да-да-да-да. Слов не знаю, потому что очень-очень давно.
Наталья Нурухамедова was a popular Uzbek singer of those times. She may not recall all the lyrics, but she definitely remembers the sense of relative freedom.
Нам больше разрешалось там, понимаете?
They let us get away with more. There weren't as many restrictions because we were so far from Moscow. And so we'd add our own style to Russian songs, to everything. We thought of ourselves as avant-garde, as experimenters.
Despite the creative sounds and energy on the dance floor, a Soviet Studio 54 this was not. Excesses were limited to the club's shadows. And more experimental Central Asian acts, like the group Arginal, heard here, faced harassment, even imprisonment, on orders of the KGB. Still, Ostinato's Vic Sahoni says mostly Soviet officials just wanted in on the fun.
They would come under the banner of, hey, we're here but from the government and we don't like what you're doing. And they wouldn't really do anything because they were like, oh, actually, this is our ticket to enter the club.
By the early 1990s, the biggest club of them all, the Soviet Union, was set to shutter its doors. Upheaval had gripped Moscow, and it rippled across the USSR. Central Asia gained its independence, but the Tashkent record factory closed. Felled by economic hardships, Western culture, and the CD. In preparing the new compilation, Anvar Kalandarov says part of his mission was to track down and finally secure licensing agreements for Central Asian artists, many of whom were once household names but never received royalties.
Some of these people aren't living as well as they should, or as well as I would like, because the proceeds from the records still go to the state.
Meanwhile, Vic Sahoni says the music's rediscovery fits into a more contemporary narrative, the shift to a multipolar world, with new global centers of influence in China, Russia, and the global South competing with the West. Some, like Russian President Vladimir Putin, have exploited the concept to justify war and conquest. Sahoni says projects like Synthesizing the Silk Roads give multipolarity a more positive spin.
This album is a soundtrack to a world that is changing very, very, very rapidly. The old networks that connected and integrated Asia with Europe, the old land routes known as the Silk Roads, they're not coming back exactly, but they are slowly reemerging.
In some ways, the mere existence of the album mirrors that global message. Ostinato is a Brooklyn-founded label, now run out of Thailand, with music curated by an Uzbek who tracked down artists from all backgrounds across Central Asia, Russia, Ukraine, even the US. Put another way, the times are a-changin'. In fact, they always were. Charles Maines, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
The deputy FBI director has historically been an apolitical job, but new appointee Dan Bongino's views are made pretty clear on his pro-Trump podcast.
The left is evil. I need you to understand. It's not just that they're wrong on politics, they are evil.
I'm Ari Shapiro. More from NPR's investigation into the Dan Bongino show on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
A divided U.S. Supreme Court is delivering a legal setback to the Trump administration in upholding a federal judge's order to release about $2 billion in foreign aid. In a vote of 5-4, justices left in place a lower court ruling that the administration must pay contractors for work that has already been completed. Justice Samuel Alito led other conservative justices in dissent. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz tells Fox News President Trump will lift the pause on U.S. aid to Ukraine if peace talks between Ukraine and Russia can be nailed down.
Yesterday and today was a positive step forward to say we are going to negotiate this peace, and we're already talking about confidence building measures that we'll then take to the Russians and test that side. This is going to be a tough shuttle diplomacy, but both sides have to enter into it. And, you know, that's what Friday put into question. I think we're moving in a positive direction now.
Well, last Friday, President Trump abruptly ended his meeting with visiting Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky after their talks devolved into a war of words in front of the media cameras. At a UK summit over the weekend, European leaders embraced Zelensky and praised his leadership in defense of his country's sovereignty 3 years after Ukraine was invaded by Russia. U.S. stocks trading lower this hour. The Dow is down 45 points at 42,475. It's NPR News. China's Premier Li Qiang has delivered a State of the Union-type address to Chinese lawmakers. NPR's John Ruich says he talked about doubling down on China's innovation push.
There might actually be a law that they pass, some legislation that would support and protect private businesses. That's interesting because the leadership has had this sort of renewed interest in private companies, especially after the Chinese company DeepSeek released an advanced AI model in January that shocked the world.
John Ruich reporting. Amid National Weather Service and federal research cuts, Maine's fishing industry is adding another concern to the list. Maine Public Radio's Nicole Grisco has more.
Maine sends about $200 million worth of lobster each year to Canada, where it's processed and sent back to the United States or to third markets. The state's top fisheries official, Pat Kelleher, says tariffs recently imposed on Canadian imports will cripple Maine's iconic lobster industry. He worries that to compensate for higher lobster prices, fishermen may be paid less for their catch.
We will see potentially hundreds of people going out of business because of these tariffs.
The state was also stripped of federal funding for marine research along the Maine coast. The announcement comes 1 week after Maine's governor publicly sparred with President Trump at the White House over transgender athlete policies. For NPR News, I'm Nicole Ugrisco in Portland, Maine.
At last check on Wall Street, the Nasdaq is down 87 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from USPS. USPS Ground Advantage service keeps customers in the know when their shipment leaves the dock, when it's on the move, and when it's delivered. Learn more at usps.com/in-the-know. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. The Supreme Court has reined in some of the Trump administration's effort to eliminate foreign aid that has been authorized by Congress. It was a 5-4 vote in this case. And with that vote, the justices supported a lower court order which tells the Trump administration to go ahead and pay contractors for work they'd already completed. This involves roughly $2 billion. It's not a final ruling. nor is it the only case. So much to discuss, and NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberger is here to discuss it. Nina, good morning.
Good morning.
How did we get here?
Well, this case began 2 weeks ago when two major foreign aid contractors went to court to challenge the Trump administration's cutoff of funds at USAID and the State Department.
Okay.
Federal Judge Amir Ali, a Biden appointee, subsequently issued a temporary restraining order to allow the continuation of foreign aid funding while he examined the issues in the case. 6 days later, the contractors went back to Judge Ali, and the judge ordered the government to pay its foreign aid contractors for work that had already been done to the tune of about $2 billion.
Hmm.
So then the Trump administration appealed to the Supreme Court to intervene. But today, in a sharply divided majority, the court refused to do that.
Oh.
It essentially left in place for now Judge Ali's order.
So the judge said to the administration, pay up. The administration didn't. So the judge said to the administration again, pay up. The administration appealed, and the Supreme Court said, no, you should pay. Is that right?
That's about right.
You want to talk this through, what the order actually says?
Well, it's an unsigned order, and it's only a page. And the court said that Judge Ali's temporary restraining order has now expired, but there are ongoing proceedings about whether he'll make that order permanent. And so the court did something then rather unusual. It actually gave Judge Ali some guidance on how to proceed, instructing him to, quote, clarify what obligations the government must fulfill to ensure compliance with the temporary restraining order, with due regard for the feasibility of any compliance timelines. In other words, the court majority basically said, if you dot your I's and cross your T's, we've got your back.
Okay, the court has the Supreme Court behind it. This judge has the Supreme Court behind him. But you said the court was divided 5-4. The dissenters have another view, I guess.
Yes, the dissenters. Writing for them, Justice Samuel Alito said, does a single district court judge have unchecked power to compel the government of the United States to pay out and probably lose forever $2 billion taxpayer dollars? The answer to that question should be an emphatic no, but a majority of this court apparently thinks otherwise. I am stunned, he said.
This really gets down to who gets to decide. Congress approved a budget. The president is asserting the right not to spend it. A judge has stepped in and said temporarily you should spend it. And now we hear from the Supreme Court at least a little bit. Does this tell you anything about how the court might rule on the larger question of who gets to decide about spending?
Well, the five justices in the majority were two conservatives, the Chief Justice and Justice Barrett, and the three liberals. The court majority didn't say much in their order, but it does, I think, tell lower court judges that they have to be careful and specific, and if they are, the majority of the court will back them up. Of course, the devil is always in the details, so we'll just have to wait and see.
You got time.
I got time. I do want to say one final thing here. Last night at the State of the Union, the four justices who attended, wearing their robes, looked to me to be terribly uncomfortable. And it can't have made anything better that Trump, as he left the chamber shaking hands, said to the Chief Justice, thank you, I won't forget, apparently referring to the immunity decision. So I think there are some tough times ahead for both of them, Roberts and the president.
The Supreme Court justice that said presidents have immunity from any of their acts. Nina, thanks so much.
Thank you.
NPR's Nina Totenberg.
President Trump says Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is ready to come to the negotiating table to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Now, this comes after that explosive meeting Friday between the two leaders at the White House. It was supposed to conclude with a deal to co-develop Ukraine's rare minerals with the U.S. Trump paused military aid to Ukraine after that meeting fell apart. Last night, though, Trump told Congress he received a letter saying that Zelensky will go ahead with that deal. NPR has not independently confirmed the existence of this letter. All that being said, policymakers in Taiwan are watching all of these developments closely. Ashish Valentine reports on this from Taipei.
Switch on any major cable news channel in Taiwan, such as TVBS, and headline news is the same.
You're gambling with World War III.
a dramatic showdown between the leaders of Ukraine and the United States. It's prompted heated debates about Taiwan's relations with the U.S. Ever since Russia's full-scale invasion 3 years ago, Taiwanese policymakers have drawn sharp parallels between Ukraine's fight and their own need to defend against a potential Chinese attack.
If we allow autocracy invaders win this war, that will be a failure of democracy.
That's Wang Dingyu, a legislator with the ruling Democratic Progressive Party. He also co-chairs the legislature's Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee. He thinks the relationship with the U.S. is still strong, despite President Trump's controversial style. But recent developments, like the pause in Ukraine aid, mean that
if you don't help yourself, nobody will. We expand our defense budget, not because of some friends require this, because we need that.
Last year alone, Chinese aircraft crossed near Taiwan over 3,000 times, according to figures from Taiwan's defense ministry. In recent weeks, many here have been wondering whether one day Taiwan could also be left out in the cold.
For Mr. Trump, it seems like there's no concept as allies. Everything is transactional, everything's be measured by how much benefit the U.S. can get.
That's Chen Fengyu, a political scientist at Suzhou University in Taipei.
We have to get used to this because Mr. Trump is always like this. This is his style.
Although the new administration has yet to detail their policy on Taiwan, Trump has, on the campaign trail, accused Taiwan of taking American jobs. This rattled many in Taiwan, but Bonnie Glaser of the German Marshall Fund think tank says it might just be a negotiating tactic. In other words, Trump's famous art of the deal.
But I believe the president is doing this simply to gain leverage, to convince Taiwan to do more things that Trump wants.
Glaser thinks that could mean getting Taiwan to import more from the U.S. and invest more in American manufacturing. Taiwanese industry is already moving in that direction. Earlier this week, Trump announced Taiwan's leading semiconductor manufacturer, TSMC, had agreed to invest $100 billion into chip manufacturing plants in the U.S.
This is a tremendous move by the most powerful company in the world. It's a matter of economic security. It's also a matter of national security for us.
This is in addition to its existing investments that had expanded considerably under the Biden administration. For NPR News, I'm Ashish Valentine in Taipei.
This is NPR News.
That the IRS could make it easier for the super rich and big corporations to cheat on their taxes. Next time, here and now.
Big news stories don't always break on your schedule. But with the NPR app, news, culture, and podcasts are ready when you want them, in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning. I'm Michelle Martin. The world's largest iceberg, called A23A, had been spiraling in the Southern Ocean since the late 1980s. In 2020, it broke free, floating north. Over the weekend, the 1,400-square-mile chunk finally ran aground off the remote island of South Georgia, home to millions of seals and penguins. But no worries. Experts say that most animals likely won't be affected and that the nutrients released could cause an explosion of life as the fresh glacier water melts into the ocean. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. It's been a long, hard winter in much of the U.S., and that's a bummer if you hate scraping ice off your car windows in the morning. But for people like NPR's Brian Mann, winter is a playground. Brian went snowshoeing in New York's Adirondack Mountains and sent us this audio postcard.
It is a classically cold winter day, 19 degrees. The woods are frosted with snow, and it's deep. I'm on my snowshoes.
I'm bundled up from head to toe, which means I'm warm. One thing I love about winter hiking is with the right boots and layers of clothes, you can feel cozy, really comfortable, exploring places like this.
The trail's taking me along the edge of a cliff, and there are cascades of ice, bright yellow, some of it kind of a glowing blue.
I'm not alone out here. Every half hour or so, a flock of chickadees swirls around me. They seem curious, some so brave they almost settle on my outstretched glove. I hike on. There are patches of blue sky through the trees and big sweeps of sunshine on the snow. It's cold, though. My breath freezes in my beard.
And now I've snowshoed up over a ridge, and I'm descending into a valley that is just completely solitary and wild. And the result is just this feeling of really deep winter, and it's really still.
A woodpecker drums in the high tree canopy. The sound makes the forest seem vast.
Now I've pushed beyond where anybody else has gone. That means that I'm breaking trail, kind of wading through snow that's up to my knees, sometimes up to my waist.
I come to the edge of a frozen lake called Wolf Pond. There's still running water here, a little river that flows under the ice, breaking over black rocks.
You can hear that different sound in my snowshoes. That's because I'm out on the ice now, on this wild mountain pond.
Big mountains rise on the horizon, glacial and white. The sky is smoky with clouds, and as I stop to rest and drink black coffee from my thermos, the snow starts to fall again. Big flakes bright against the winter woods. Brian Mann, NPR News, in New York's Adirondack Mountains.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, we'll go to North Carolina, where a 24-hour team of operators try to fact-check rumors about immigration enforcement before they get out of control and cause panic. Listen on your smartphone, your smart speaker, or on your radio. This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Key West in Florida has been studying how cruise ships docking there affect water quality. But as NPR's Greg Allen reports, Key West responded to some alarming results by putting testing on hold indefinitely.
On a typical warm and sunny February day in Key West, people stream off a cruise ship that towers over the dock and surrounding shops. Not far away, a device in the harbor has been keeping track of the area's water quality for more than a year.
So this is the testing platform here.
Arlo Haskell is with the Key West Committee for Safer, Cleaner Ships.
There are two sensors down there, one relatively close to the surface and a second relatively close to the bottom, picking up environmental readings of dozens and dozens of different substances and scientific parameters.
5 years ago, Safer, Cleaner Ships got voter initiatives on the ballot that would set limits on the size and number of cruise ships that could call on Key West. They passed, but were quickly nullified by a law signed by the governor that preempted the city's ability to limit cruise ships. Under an agreement with the private owner of the cruise pier, one ship per day now can call on Key West. At the same time, the city began monitoring the water quality in the cruise port. Haskell says a key issue is something called turbidity, how much mud and fine sediment are stirred up when cruise ships enter the harbor.
You have these very large vessels with their keels very close to the bottom, and what you see is giant clouds of sedimentation, of silt.
Fortunately for Key West, a local school, College of the Florida Keys, was willing to run the water quality tests. At a city commission meeting in November, marine researcher Patrick Rice had some bad news for local officials. Tests showed more than 30 occasions where turbidity stirred up by cruise ships exceeded limits set by the EPA. He showed commissioners a graph with data from the cruise port.
And what you can see is, on this particular day, one cruise ship had two turbidity events associated with it that exceeded EPA standards by more than three times.
Captain Will Benson cares a lot about water quality in the Keys. He's a fishing guide who's seen the decline in tarpon and on the reefs.
The turbidity kind of comes up and gets washed around the island, and it makes our waters less clear. It has an impact on seagrasses, has an impact on hard bottom communities, and it has an impact on the coral reef.
Benson was disappointed with how Key West commissioners responded to the water quality tests. They were particularly concerned about testing for turbidity, which raised a red flag about the impact of cruise ships. Some members suggested the testing unfairly targets the cruise industry and voted not to renew the college's contract to do water quality testing for the city. The commission is looking for another organization to conduct the testing. In the meantime, city-sponsored tests have been suspended, while cruise ships come and go almost daily. Key West Mayor Didi Enriquez didn't respond to interview requests, but on Key West radio station US1, she said officials aren't putting politics over the environment.
We are fully transparent. We have nothing to hide, and we remain committed to ensuring water quality for our community.
Key West Commissioner Sam Kaufman tried to convince other commissioners to renew the city's agreement with College of the Keys, or at least allow researchers to leave their equipment in the harbor. He was unsuccessful.
We're a tourist destination, and our lifeblood is the water. People come here to dive the reef. People come here to fish. People come here just to look at the beauty of our environment. It's a really important issue for all of us here in Key West.
Kaufman says College of the Florida Keys has funding from the federal government for now and is likely to continue its work monitoring water quality with or without the city's cooperation. If the city does find a replacement, he's hoping in the end Key West will end up with more, not less, data on the island's water. Greg Allen, NPR News, Key West.
Some people struggle with sensory overload. We had a guy in the program last year who said he finds the subway overwhelming. He has to time his ride for when it's less crowded. Other people have sensory processing difficulty when they're getting a haircut. Bright lights, lots of touch. Nebraska Public Media's Arthur Jones visited a hair salon that wants to respond.
Sensory Sweet Spot on Omaha's west side is a barbershop that caters mostly to kids. What's different about this salon is it provides sensory accessible haircuts. Here, clients who are bothered by loud sounds or sensitive to touch can get their own room away from others, play with fidget toys, and can watch TV.
My tummy feels good.
Owner Juanita Encontro got the idea from her sister, who had tried to offer sensory accessible haircuts at other salons. But she was always eventually asked to leave because her clients were considered disruptive.
As her big sister, I decided to open up our own salon suite that would cater to anybody with sensory needs.
Hey.
Stephanie Skogseth is an enthusiastic client. Her 5-year-old son, Harrison, didn't come with her today, but she has been bringing him to the shop since it opened 5 months ago.
He loves cars and trains. Yeah, he's just this happy, energetic boy.
Her son has been diagnosed with autism, so sometimes all of the close buzzing sounds and the touching that take place in a typical salon can be overwhelming for him. But Skogseth says the barbers know how to work with her son, giving him breaks when he needs them, and are able to cut his hair even if he is having a difficult day.
They understand that, and they never once make me feel guilty about it. They never once make me feel like, control your child or anything like that.
According to the American Medical Association Journal, 1 in 6 kids have sensory processing difficulties. Although this Omaha salon is one of the few fully sensory accessible ones in the region, it reflects a growing trend to make everyday life easier for individuals who may experience anxiety or discomfort, or could have strong physical reactions to environments they find overwhelming. Meg Raby Klinghoffer works at Culture City, an international nonprofit that certifies organizations that want to learn more about sensory needs. She says it's important for them and others to understand the difference between offering people sensory-friendly spaces, which are temporary accommodations, and sensory-accessible ones.
By providing sensory accessibility and inclusion 24/7, you're pretty much just giving them something naturally that they need to function at their optimal levels, and you're not putting like a time frame or limitations on that. I mean, that is inclusion, right?
Autism advocate and author Kaylin Partlow says even though haircuts may seem like a small example of sensory accessibility, places like Sensory Sweet Spot fulfill a need.
You know, there's a handful of folks who are not able to leave their homes without certain sensory accommodations, and without that, they will not be able to participate. So it's hugely important for just inclusion and access purposes.
Parlo's main bit of advice for parents like Stephanie Skogseth is to keep advocating for accessible spaces. Skogseth says she has no plans to stop fighting for her son.
As a mom, my biggest fear with raising a child on the spectrum isn't so much him as much as other people, and like making sure people can be kind to him and his differences.
And she says that is exactly what she gets at Sensory Sweet Spot.
Oh, there you go.
Good job.
For National Public Radio, I'm Arthur Jones in Omaha.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.